Tomorrow night, there is a community screening of a new documentary called Black and Blue. It's all about the escalating tensions between police officers and the Black community, and it profiles a Black Kansas City police officer, Donald Carter, who sometimes feels caught in the middle, worried that other Black people might see him in uniform and think of him as a sellout.
I don't want to be that dude. Like, the same thing whenever I was first thinking about becoming an officer. Like, I don't want to be that dude that other people see as something that they don't like or can't connect with. And it would happen often. Yeah, that dream came, or that fear manifested several times.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're starting today's show on KCUR's Central Standard with the maker of that documentary, Solomon Bass. Hi, Solomon.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How about you?
I'm good.
Tell me about Donald Carter, the police officer whose voice we just heard.
Well, he's actually a former police officer.
Former police officer. Important distinction.
Yeah, definitely. I went to school with him. We went to high school together, and as you know, as life goes on, you know, you go your separate ways, and we bumped into each other again, and I seen he was doing a lot of things in the community, and as the idea started to come together, he came into my mind, and like, he was the center of this documentary, and he was down for it.
You know, you started making this movie just after Ferguson, not with any grand plan, but as a filmmaker, you heard what was going on, and your instinct was to rush over to St. Louis with your camera. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. I was actually headed back from St. Louis when it was happening, right when Mike Brown got shot. I was leaving St. Louis. And 2 days later, I said, why not just get my camera and go?
What were you feeling personally in those days, in those moments? Between the time when you heard what was happening and decided to get in your car and go?
Well, you know, watching the news, all you see is tear gas and, you know, people running and all this. So I didn't know what I was going to get myself into. I was expecting the worst. So I was expecting my camera to get broke, whatever. You know, I was just going to take that risk. And it was wild.
What was it like? I mean, tell me more about that.
One night, it was just about 600-700 people at the police station, and this is nighttime, so you don't see everything. You know, you got snipers on the roof. The police are on the roof sniping. You got the community bringing their own music, just protesting, just sharing their heart and sharing their feelings and their frustration. And the police was like warning them to leave, and they stayed for. Because I was there too. We stayed till at least 4 in the morning. And they was warning around like 10 o'clock p.m.
You were there as a filmmaker, but you're still a human being.
Yeah, definitely.
And I'm curious about what you were feeling outside of your project to just capture this on film.
I mean, I tried to stay in the filmmaker mode, you know, so I didn't get so emotional or too emotional to where I didn't capture what I needed to capture. Because, you know, if the camera's off, all I have is memories, you know. But if I keep the camera on, you know, I can see that. I can use it for later, just like I just did. But it was heartbreaking. Like, it definitely was heartbreaking. I came home definitely a different person.
In what way?
Just wanting to help our community more, just awaken more. You know, I was... You know, we're so distracted with things day to day, you know, trying to do this, trying to do that. And you're not really worried about what's going on for real. And our community, we need help. So I was awakened, definitely.
Was there a moment that you would consider to be a moment of awakening, or was it the whole journey all put together?
Yeah, I say the whole journey, but I had a friend down there who he was running things, and they told me how one night, how they were the first to stop traffic in on the highway. Like, they were the first ones to do it. And I asked them how they do it. And they took a big flashlight and stopped the semi truck. You know, they said the semi truck was like 5 feet from them. You know, they took that risk. And, you know, the stories, man, those stories were just exciting.
Had you had any experiences with police officers that made this topic feel personal to you?
Well, definitely. Black police officers, I wouldn't say in my youth, no. I look at police officers now, and you know, I see now that I'm awakened, I kind of see what needs to be done, you know. And I have a relationship with a couple because I'm a security guard, you know, and it's broken me down to see them as more human beings than, you know, robots or the enemy or a sellout or whatever the case.
So you had at one point seen police officers as the enemy?
Yeah, definitely.
Tell me about
that. I still struggle with that. I'm not going to lie to you. Just for, you know, what's going on, you know, I feel like we're endangered species, you know, black men. So, and the police are part of that issue. So just being a black man, you know, I can't do nothing but feel that, you know, day to day, what you go through. I know I get racially profiled. You know, I get looked over. You know, because of my skin color, all that stuff. So you know, I deal with that daily.
The experience of being a security guard seems like it would cast some of that in maybe a little bit different light, or just make it feel really complicated.
Definitely, it was just a job for me. You know, just being a security, you know, it was just a job for me until I started to rub shoulders with a couple police officers, and then I started to experience kind of what police officers experience, because they would look at me as a police. They would, hey, that's police. No, I'm not police. I'm security. I try to clear that up quick. Like, no, I'm not a police. I'm security. But you know, I started to get backlash from my own community.
Is there a story you'd be willing to tell about that?
Definitely. I was in the emergency room and I seen a couple young guys who needed help. I knew they needed help, like directions. And, you know, I speak their language.
So you're security at a hospital?
Yeah. And I spoke their language, you know, what's up, fam? What's up, bro? All that. You know, I tried to come relational with them. And they gave me the cold shoulder. I mean, they looked at me like I was the devil, you know what I mean? So, and I brushed it off, but it kind of stuck with me. To where I end up bumping into them later and they still needed help. So I'm like, what's up, y'all? You know what I'm saying? Can I help y'all? Whatever. We end up talking, you know, I end up helping them. And they were like, hey, bro, you know, we apologize for being like that. You know, we thought you was one of them. And I'm like, nah, it ain't like that. So, you know, I went back and I just thought about what black officers go through, what black police officers go through. You know, just me being a security guard, you know. And I know what they go through, so it just, that struck my vision for this.
So for you, as someone who had all this footage from Ferguson, and then you're thinking about your own experience as a security guard, can you tell me about how this all shaped into the idea that it's turned into, which is telling the story of these tensions through the character of the former black police officer?
You know, It all tied in because it's all the same subject. You know, we got black males being killed. We got black males in our community. You know, black police officers in the community, they're not going anywhere. You know, the white police officers, they need to learn, you know, some things. So hopefully this documentary can, like, raise some awareness to everyone. You know what I mean?
You know, have you seen the movie Black Klansman yet?
Not yet.
There's this character of the first black police officer on this Colorado police force. Mm-hmm. He feels this tension of where he fits within the police force and then also where he fits within the black community. Mm-hmm. Is that something you talked with Donald about?
Yeah, definitely. If you come, you know, you'll definitely see. He said it was hard. You know, one thing he stuck with me, he said, we would call on the police, on the black police when we're in trouble, but when they don't meet our needs, then they're Uncle Tom, you know, then they're the enemy, you know, if they can't meet whatever we needed them to do, you know. So he felt like it's a tug both ways, you know, I got to do my job, but at the same time, I want to please my people. So
did your attitude change in the process of moving past just your own day-to-day lived experience, what you see on the news, and doing some real research? Because you do these interviews. You also go on ride-alongs with police. You do a lot of research in the course of making this documentary.
Well, one thing that was a little disappointing, I couldn't get as much police footage from the Kansas City Police Department. They really kind of got a pack or whatever. So, but going through the neighborhoods and just seeing what the community felt, you know, more towards no, you know, black people shouldn't be officers, but then you had some saying yes, you know. So, you know, I was thinking we would just have all no's, no. But, you know, we got a lot of people out here that's for that. And
that are people who are for more black people on the police force.
Definitely. And I will say I'm for that.
Can you explain that the sort of crux of that debate?
At a certain extent, if, you know, it's all about your intentions, you know. And I'm not saying be a police officer just to help your people. If you're black, you know, but I'm saying, like, be a tool, you know what I'm saying? You're there for a reason. Be a tool, you know, you can make some kind of difference.
Do you feel that way even as a security guard, which you take pains to make clear it's not a police officer?
I see it every day, you know, I see it every day. I try to creep in the cracks with my people when I see them, you know. And if I see an altercation, I come in, you know, and I'll come in with a couple of white officers, you know, and they do it how they do it, but I do it how I do it, you know. And
what's the difference?
Energy, you know. We have the same energy, you know. I know how to come to my people, you know. I just know how I would want to be come to, you know. I don't want to be looked at as I'm a problem maker. You know, I want to see if you want to solve the problem. Like, come and see what's the problem. Not are you the problem?
That's a really important distinction too.
Yeah.
Well, I have not had the opportunity to see this documentary, but there is a clip that I've been able to see from what looks to me like a Black Lives Matter rally, maybe right after Ferguson.
Actually, that was the march. That was the big march, the start of the big march of Ferguson.
Wow.
Yeah, she launched it, and that was her speech.
Okay, we're going to hear some of this speech. One of the leaders is telling the crowd that they can't trust this country to protect them. I'm going to play this clip now.
Today, this moment, we protect each other. We love each other. No one will protect us but us.
That's right.
Today, we show each other what family means. When we come out here today, when we march, I need every single one of y'all to be looking out for each other. We have been shown that we cannot trust this country to protect us. So I need y'all to remember that we are community. We are family. This is your people.
What stands out to you now listening to this clip years later?
Man, it was the anticipation of the rush. Like, I remember, like, right when it started, the energy was so high. Everybody screaming, everybody chanting, everybody playing drums, just expressing their way of their frustration or whatever.
Thinking about the experience of a black police officer and how someone in that position might hear the clip we just listened to, I am really struck by the line about how no one will protect black people except black people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what about this idea of there being this charge to serve and protect, and then the pressure that puts on a black police officer if the idea is that's the only officer who's going to protect this community?
That's the struggle. That's the struggle within the officer that they have to deal with. And that's, it's a hard job to do. So, you know, but with that, you know, you got to take on that responsibility, you know. And it's not going to go away because the seed's been planted a long time ago. You know, police versus the black community, being white, black, whatever the case. So, you know, we're just picking up the pieces or trying to do what we have to do now. But black police, yeah, I feel sorry for them actually, because the black community is not, they're not feeling that right now.
What is your hope as you gear up to screen this movie at a community center here in town? Who do you want to show up? What kind of discussion do you want to see happen?
Well, I definitely want the black community to come, just, you know, my people. But I would definitely love to see some black officers, even Kansas City PD, just period. You know, the hardest part was taking a big old ball and making a little piece, you know. So I couldn't tackle the whole issue, but I'm raising awareness, you know, 30 minutes of awareness. Just the black community and the black police officers, we need to bridge that gap.
Can I just say that I like your t-shirt? You're wearing a t-shirt that says, what does it say?
Say it right. You say it.
Okay. Nah.
Yep. Nah.
Rosa Parks, 1955.
Yep. So I was to be said, nah.
Solomon Bass, thank you for being here today. I will look forward to seeing this movie for sure.
Definitely.
There's a screening of Black and Blue tomorrow night at the Southwest Community Center on East 63rd Street. Up next on KCUR Central Standard, bacteria with resistance to antibiotics are super scary. And a scientist at KU may be finding solutions. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now Joanna Slusky is with us. She's a researcher at KU taking what looks like a promising new approach to the whole problem of antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria. The National Institutes of Health have taken note in the form of $2.3 million worth of support for her lab and the work they're doing. So let's find out what is going on there. Joanna Slusky, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so let's back up and make sure we're all starting from the same place here. Antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria. How does that happen? Take us back to science class.
We don't know how it happens, actually. It's a big part of debate right now. A lot of people think that it happens because the bacteria are being exposed to antibiotics. But
That's not just a known fact?
It's not just a known fact.
You're already blowing my mind.
So there have been studies that have shown that there are bacterial resistance mechanisms that happen even without the presence of antibiotics. And so we're not really sure if it happens because of that or not. There have also been studies that have shown that you get more resistance the more you expose bacteria to antibiotics. So it seems like it's a mechanism that happens. We're not sure if it's the only mechanism or if it's the dominant mechanism.
But we
have to fight it either way.
Yeah. In what way is a strain of bacteria changing that makes it resistant?
It's a great question. There are basically three ways that make them resistant. So for every antibiotic, and there are a number of classes of antibiotics that people take and that get used, but these antibiotics each target a particular protein in the cell. And so if that target is mutated, then that target can't be bound by the antibiotic anymore, and the antibiotic doesn't work.
But so when you say bound, mm-hmm. we're just taking it.
Yeah.
Really, like, there are all these terms that we use, and I'm not sure if all of us can really picture what's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
When an antibiotic goes and gets a bacteria, mm-hmm. what's happening? What is it doing?
So it's shutting off some main pathway in bacteria that's central to the bacteria's life. Like, the analogy we could use is that, you know, humans need to eat and breathe to stay alive. And let's say an antibiotic came, it could lodge itself in our lungs. And a human,
yeah,
we're the bacteria in this analogy.
Yeah.
So something comes and it lodges itself in our lungs, it kills us that way. something comes and it lodges itself in our esophageal system and then we can't eat, it kills us that way. So there are all these different things that bacteria need to live that if you plug them up, if you stop that pathway from happening, the bacteria will die.
How could any bacteria not succumb to this force that is the antibiotic in the story you've just told me?
Well, so what if it makes its mouth a different shape? And then this antibiotic that was really good at plugging up its mouth doesn't fit there anymore. So that's one way in the story that works. The other way is that it actually comes up with a way. It comes up with teeth. And all of a sudden it can change the antibiotic so it can bite the antibiotic, and then the antibiotic is a different shape or a different size, and then it doesn't lodge in our mouths either. But either of those ways, you can still, let's say, get the lungs, even if you can't get the mouth or things like that. The bigger issue in my mind is that it has an excretory system, okay, where it basically just anything that comes in, it pushes it out.
A bacteria?
The bacteria does.
Okay.
So the bacteria.
Why is that a big deal?
Well, so all of these antibiotics come in, and if it has this system which pushes everything out, then they never reach the mouth or the lungs or anything like that. Or if they do, then they
come
off.
So we're still talking in the form of an analogy, we're imagining that bacteria are people.
Right. So in this analogy,
so
bacteria are people,
it.
So you can picture it. So that when I'm talking about killing a bacteria, if you don't know what it looks like to kill a bacteria, you may have some unfortunate interaction with killing a person. And so that's the analogy I'm using, where it's either, sticking to some place where it causes something to die, or it's not. And if it can just push everything out, then it never sticks to the places that'll kill the bacteria.
So is that the question that you are asking in your lab right now?
So the bacteria have these pumps that push all of the antibiotics out. And one of the things that we're working on in my lab, and this is what garnered all that funding from the NIH, is how do we disable that system that pushes everything out? Can we disable that system so that everything just stays in?
So what is it? It seems like this is different from other research that has been done, in part because you're not focused on finding a new approach to making antibiotics.
Yeah, it is. So I think it's important to come up with new antibiotics, but that's a difficult process. Both chemically. Look, what we're doing is a difficult process chemically also. So it's sort of pick your difficult chemical process. But then there are difficult economics associated with coming up with new antibiotics. Because if you come up with a new antibiotic, then it becomes an antibiotic of last resort. And there's so much funding, beyond even the kind of funding that I receive, but you need so many years of preclinical testing, clinical trials to get a drug to market so that we know that it's safe, which is so important. But chemical companies end up footing that bill. And if something becomes a drug of last resistance, then physicians aren't allowed to prescribe it unless it's a situation where it requires a drug of last resistance.
Where everything else has been tried.
Exactly. And so
and then
you
that
can't
also make
your money back.
Does it make it also very
companies.
Expensive, that drug?
It depends. I mean, so that all depends on pricing models from the pharmaceutical industry. And I don't know anything about that or anything about legislation that's done for life-saving life-saving technologies and how that stuff gets priced.
Say you figure out a way to make bacteria incapable of pushing out antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get that? Is that also a drug? How do you get that to the bacteria?
It's a great question. And that's something we're working on actively, right? This idea, the idea would be that either this could be something that could be packaged along with antibiotics or taken along with antibiotics, and it would have to be able to reach the bacterial infection just like the antibiotic does and work together.
So take me back to the moment that you started asking yourself questions about how bacteria excrete antibiotics.
So it was conversations I had with my colleagues at KU that I was really interested in these pumps that push out antibiotics, that excrete the antibiotics. And
you would really describe these as pumps?
Yeah, we call them pumps. So they take, it's a technical term to call them a pump. They take energy to push out the antibiotics. And so they're not just passive channels or things like that, but they're actually physically pushing so that there can be a lower concentration inside than outside, which is otherwise thermodynamically less stable.
My idea of what a bacteria is and what it is capable of doing just grew a great deal listening to you, because I just have the idea that it's this shape basically moving through your system that mucks up the works. But the idea that it has such a complex inner working, that it's using energy to pump out something that is a danger to itself.
Absolutely. I mean, bacteria are extraordinarily complex, and they're, I mean, this is going to be obvious, but they're alive, right? And they're trying to stay alive, and they, you know, are living next to all these other types of bacteria, and they're all trying to live in this, you know, sometimes harmonious relationship, right? They're all, but their goal is survival, and there are hundreds of thousands of proteins that they're making in order to, you know, go about their daily lives of eating and breathing and, you know, living in various environments.
So in this sci-fi version of this, is it really like, would you cast this as us against them? Everyone's trying to survive?
Yes, possibly. I don't think that's so far off. I mean, yes, it's us against them and everyone's trying to survive. But just like, you know, in any real war situation, there are all of these other parties, right? In the Revolutionary War, it wasn't just us against the British, but the Hessians were involved, or, you know, whatever it is. So there are tons of other, so if it's a bacterial infection, that's a problem, right? There are tons of other bacteria and fungus and whatever there is that's part of our body, that's part of this system, and that's helping us or helping them, and these other chemicals that are being exploited by us versus them, which are antibiotics or which are various food sources for the bacteria. So it's a very complex war, but yes.
I've read some critique of this, the way we talk about medicine in particular, mm-hmm. as a battle, like that if someone has a disease, that they're mm-hmm. fighting this battle against that disease. Mm-hmm. And that taking a more holistic approach of that I'm not fighting something inside myself, mm-hmm. that I'm just trying to like get myself to a place of health and understand mm-hmm. all of the complex things that go into that. It sounds like...
So those are both true, right? Those are two sides of describing the same biochemical reality that's happening. Absolutely. And so, yeah, there is, because, you know, with these complex war analogies where there are other bacteria, right, that are doing things that are for us and not for, they're not friends with the pathogenic bacteria or whatever, this bacteria that's infecting you. And so the idea that it's us versus them, us versus the bacteria, when there are bacteria that are helping us, or that it's us versus the cancer when cancer is sort of a fundamental part of our own human biology or whatever it is. It's just like war is complicated and it's not clear, you know, in the case of war, they're all people and they're all just trying to survive in some way. Same thing.
So, okay, I've gotten us way off track, but I'm still
interested. I don't do research on war.
I'm still interested in this moment when you were talking to your colleagues at KU, mm-hmm. chatting about bacteria like you do.
Mm-hmm. And like you do.
And you come up with this new way of thinking about antibiotic-resistant bacteria, yeah. and what we can do about this.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was trying to study these pumps because I thought these pumps were super interesting from an extraordinarily obscure chemical reason.
And just in case people have recently tuned in, these are pumps in bacteria that push out antibiotics.
Exactly. So they're pushing out antibiotics. And I was not really focusing on pushing out antibiotics. And one of my colleagues said, hey, could you stop those pumps from working? And I was kind of like, yeah, I think that the things that we're doing could, that we're already doing would stop the pumps from working.
Well, and who's we and what things are we already doing?
Great question. So we is my lab. I have an amazing team of researchers. And in this case, it was something that Cyril Cook and Panakin Sukthankar were working on. And I was talking to my colleague, Scott Hefty, who is the one who suggested to me, hey, could you stop this pumping action from happening? Could you stop it? Antibiotics from getting pushed out of the bacteria so that the bacteria would be actually killed by the antibiotics. And what we were already doing was trying to change how that pump formed, because the pump forms in this very interesting biochemical way. And so we were trying to change it so we could understand how it forms better. And he said, hey, could you stop it from forming? And I was like, yeah, I think that's, at least if we're not totally understanding how it's forming, we're certainly capable of stopping it from forming. So let's keep working with that. And so the things that we had already had were things that were stopping it from forming. And so we just sort of kept going on that track.
How do you do all of this? You're describing things that sound really abstract to me, but mm-hmm. I don't know what a scientist does in a lab that makes all of this happen. I mean, just a reminder that we are talking about microscopic organisms.
Right. So these...
And pumps inside microscopic organisms, I have to imagine, are even more microscopic.
Right. So we don't take, like, tweezers to them and poke them or anything like that. But the idea is that you can grow bacteria and you can add antibiotics to the, you know, you've got some liquid that you're growing the bacteria in and it has all the nutrients that bacteria love, so they're thriving, and you throw some antibiotics in it and it kills the bacteria. Okay? And so the question then is, you know, how much antibiotics do you need to kill that bacteria? And if you have this extra chemical that we're making, do you need less antibiotics because less of it's getting pushed out? And so that's like, so then we've got, you know, three tubes, one with, you know, one amount of anti, they all have, all the three tubes have bacteria in them, and all of them have the same amount of antibiotics. And one of the tubes has, let's say, no chemical extra. And one of the tubes has some of this extra chemical, and one of the tubes has lots of this extra chemical, this chemical that's stopping the antibiotics from getting pushed out. And then you can see that at the same amount of antibiotics, you get more bacteria that are dying from the same amount of antibiotics because of these extra chemicals.
So in the law of unintended consequences, which is that there always are unintended mm-hmm. consequences, do you have any fears? I mean, do you?
Oh, yeah.
Does your brain have to kind of go there as you start, like,
sure.
messing with the internal functions of bacteria?
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah. I mean, so first of all, I told you in our grand war analogy, us against the bacteria, but it turns out that there are plenty of bacteria that are helping us, and plenty of other types of cells in our body. So the chemical that we're using, we haven't tried it against human cells. We don't anticipate that it'll have any effect on human cells because of the particular chemical nature of this particular protein we're working on. But there are lots of good bacteria that we want to keep. We don't want to totally wipe out our microbiomes, and we have
antibiotics. They don't discriminate one bacteria to
different,
another.
Different antibiotics work in different ways. So there are different. There's such a wide variety of bacteria, and some of them, back to the analogy I said before, where if the antibiotics are trying to kill in different ways, right, some of them don't have lungs, or some of them don't have the same shaped lungs. So when you're trying to get the lungs of
Now we're in an analogy.
No bacteria have lungs.
In real life.
Humans have lungs, and we're trying to kill the humans, which we're calling bacteria. It's a complicated analogy. Work with me. So the point is that, like, some bacteria don't have the same shape lungs, or don't have lungs at all, or whatever it is. And so any antibiotic that was targeting the lungs simply isn't going to work for that type of bacteria.
But one bacteria that has whatever feature an antibiotic is targeting is gonna get wiped out by that antibiotic, even if it's not the bacteria you were going for.
Exactly.
And it might be a perfectly friendly bacteria.
Exactly. And similarly, the question is, lots of different bacteria have this type of pump that pumps out antibiotics. So how specific is this chemical that we're making to the pump for the pathogenic bacteria as opposed to the pump for the bacteria that's part of your helpful microbiome? And that we just don't know yet.
So how do you start figuring that out?
Oh, so look, we start by seeing if it, okay, it affects this one type of bacteria. Let's try this other type of bacteria. Oh, it affects that type of bacteria or doesn't? What do we do that can make it affect, one bacteria versus another bacteria? So, we're working with a protein, so we can make amino acid changes. We can make chemical changes to see if that will change whether or not it works on lots of types of bacteria or only an individual type of bacteria. But and then the question is, ultimately, getting into bacteria that are infecting human cells and seeing in that situation, as opposed to the situation that I told you about where we're in a test tube and we're putting just bacteria food in there, how does that affect multiple groups of bacteria?
So if you are approaching this by looking at what you can do to bacteria mm-hmm. instead of what you can do to antibiotics, that is interesting to me because the popular wisdom on this seems to be, at least right now, that that the antibiotics are the problem. You know what I mean? That not in all situations, that there are situations where they're absolutely vital. That's why mm-hmm. we care about bacteria becoming mm-hmm. resistant to them in the first place. Mm-hmm. But that our overexposure, some would say, to antibiotics and our over-reliance on them is just inherently a problem.
Mm-hmm. And I think, so I'm not sure what our there's our basic biological reliance on them. When you're infected with a bacteria, you then are become reliant on antibiotics. And I'm not sure that that's the problem. I'm not sure if what you're talking about is a psychological reliance on bacteria, our psychological need to see antibacterial written on our hand soaps and on our toothpaste and on our dish soap. Right. That psychological problem is probably outside the scope of my research. But I think you're right that it.
Do you think that is a problem?
So this goes back to where we started, where you said, what causes antibiotic resistance? And it does seem like something that encourages antibiotic resistance is lots of exposure to antibiotics. And so putting antibiotics where they're not needed in our hand soap, in our dish soap, wherever it is. That becomes a problem because that gets not just on our countertops, but it goes into the groundwater. It goes everywhere that the bacteria are and that the bacteria are slowly then building up resistance to those antibiotics. That does seem to be a problem. And the FDA, I know, is working to curtail at least some of that. But it would be great if we had less of a psychological need for it because that would really stop it in its tracks.
How do you distinguish a psychological need for antibacterial, whatever it is, and a real need for?
I mean, that's up to the physicians, but it seems like there are diagnostics, right, that can tell you if you have a bacterial infection, and there need to be better diagnostics for that. And that's something actually that my lab has been dabbling with, this idea that there are some things which it seems like you just have vast overprescription for antibiotics, various types of respiratory conditions people are always getting antibiotics for, and it seems like more than 50% of the antibiotics that are prescribed for respiratory conditions are unnecessary. But there are other things which, sometimes your strep throat, sometimes your sore throat is bacterial, and sometimes it's viral. And
really? I thought strep can be still.
So not strep.
Oh, sorry.
Sore throat. You come
sore
in with a sore throat.
Okay.
And I can't, I'm not a physician, but my impression is you don't immediately know unless you take, specifically a strep test, if it's streptococcus or if it's something else, if something else is actually infecting
right.
your throat. And so being able to detect that quickly so that you can get, because you don't want to wait 3 days for the bacterial culture to grow up and be like, oh, yeah, that looks like that looks like streptococcus and not nothing. So you can't wait those 3 days. You have to go to work. And you're hoping to get better by the next day. So you want antibiotics now in case it's strep throat. And that's why we have to have these rapid diagnostic tests, because we're all so busy we can't wait.
Well, so in the meantime, as bacteria appear to be becoming more resistant for whatever reason, you are invading their bodies.
I got lost in the analogy. I'm invading the bacteria's body?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean, okay.
That's what you're doing in your lab.
In my lab, we're invading the bacterial body. Yeah, so that's the question. I don't anticipate that what we're making is something that would be prescribed for a day-to-day strep throat kind of case. First of all, it wouldn't work on strep. Strep doesn't have these pumps, as it happens. But that I anticipate that we do have, when you're in a hospital, when you try a couple of antibiotics and they don't work, that's when we get to the point where they're like, oh, let's actually test how resistant this particular strain is. And that's, I think, where this would come in.
Joanna Slusky, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Joanna Slusky has joined us from the KU Department of Molecular Biosciences. I'm Gina Kaufman, and there's still one more story to tell on KCUR's Central Standard. It was about the day Langston Hughes was born. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And if you read the New York Times, you might have noticed an article on the birthday of the poet Langston Hughes, one of the major voices of the Harlem Renaissance. Turns out Langston Hughes might have been born a year earlier than we thought. So before we go, we're going to talk to the Washburn University professor in Topeka who made that discovery by total accident. Eric McHenry, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
So first of all, tell me the story of how you figured this out.
Well, I had recently discovered this resource, newspapers.com, which is an online archive of digitized, mostly historical newspapers. And it's the sort of thing I'm very susceptible to, like a rabbit hole that I can just disappear down for hours at a time. So I was potching around on the site, looking up various figures, specifically African-American artists with connections to the Lawrence or Topeka community, which is sort of an interest of mine. And I was finding fascinating stuff on the families of Gwendolyn Brooks and Coleman Hawkins and the blues musician Gatemouth Moore and the visual artist Aaron Douglas and the comedian George Walker and Langston Hughes. I was also finding quite a few little articles and entries and squibs on, particularly in the Topeka Plain Dealer, which is an African-American newspaper that ran in Topeka from 1899 until 1958. And at some point, I realized that I was reading an item about little Langston Hughes, who had been under the weather recently, and the date on
as a
the
child?
Issue of the newspaper was, yes, little Langston Hughes as a child, yeah. And there were several in there. I'd already seen some about little Langston Hughes as a child, and so I wasn't surprised by that, but it was just sort of a society page item, you know, little bits of gossip and information about the African-American community and who was having dinner with whom and things like that. But here was little Langston Hughes under the weather, and the date of the issue was right next to it, and it was December 20th, 1901, which was a month and a half before Langston Hughes was born. And my eyes sort of bugged out, and I wondered if I was really seeing what I was seeing, and I tried to explain it away and rationalize it, but in any event, over the next 24 hours or so, I did a lot more searching in a very targeted way for that time frame and found other references to young Langston Hughes in the year 1901 in a way that made it clear that it was the same Langston Hughes. It referred to his mother, Carrie Hughes, and they were off to Buffalo, New York, which is where Langston Hughes' father was living in the spring of 1901. And so it became pretty clear pretty soon that it was just conclusive evidence that this was the Langston Hughes.
Okay. And I want to pick back up on this story, and then I'm going to ask you later what else you found out about little Langston Hughes. But
sure.
Why does it matter if Langston Hughes was born a year earlier than we thought? Does it?
That's a really good question. Yeah, and I think in some ways it does not at all, and in some ways it does. Initially I thought, well, this is just a little biographical detail about Langston Hughes. It's nothing, you know, super earth-shattering. It's certainly interesting, and you know, a biographer would want to know it. But what's the real significance? The more I thought about it, the more I thought it is interesting and curious in that it suggests that at some point in his life, he or someone else changed his birth date. Denise Lowe, a poet who lives in Lawrence and who's a friend of mine and a Langston Hughes researcher as well, found censuses, among other things, that sort of corroborated these newspaper items. There were three consecutive censuses that listed ages that would have corresponded with a 1901 birth date for Langston Hughes. So for a while, it was kind of an established fact that he was born in 1901, but apparently at some point he shaved a year off of his age, and speculating about why he might have wanted to do that, what he stood to gain by doing that, that's where it becomes more interesting, I think. But that's where it might shed light on his life in some interesting ways.
Have you started to speculate on that?
Oh, I definitely have speculated on it, and others have as well, others who know Langston Hughes and his family and his story a lot better than I do. And we have various theories, but of course none of them are anything like conclusive the way that this paper evidence is conclusive, that he did change the date or someone did change the date. He might have done it when his mother might have made the decision for him when she was enrolling him in school. He started first grade in Topeka, and she got him enrolled in an all-white school. This was years before Brown versus the Board of Education, but she was able to convince the school board to let him into the Harrison Street School, which is an all-white school. But of course, he was going to be encountering, you know, the problems that an African-American child would at an all-white school in 1908. And it may be that she decided to enroll him a year late, allowing him to be a year bigger and a year more developmentally advanced than his cohort or his peers, but not wanting anyone to know that, you know, and so to give him sort of a little bit of additional armor against some of the discrimination he was going to encounter. So that's one theory, and there are others that I could go into more detail on. But
I would say that does matter quite a bit, that detail, then, once you start imagining why.
I think so, too, yeah. And the other Langston Hughes scholars that I spoke to were certainly intrigued by it and were interested in speculating about it. It's not sort of the same thing as discovering that, you know, he actually weighed 155 pounds in 1941, but he said he only weighed 150, you know, or something like that. It seems like it has more biographical implications than something truly trivial like that.
You know, you were researching all these newspapers in Kansas because you were trying to find out something about your own background. Can you share that with me, with our listeners?
Yeah, so that's how I discovered newspapers.com, how I got started on all of this. Was I was having dinner at a friend's house with an old friend who no longer lives in Topeka, but who I was schoolmates with, a poet named Ed Skoog, who now lives in Portland. And we got to talking over dinner about how we realized we both had ancestors from Kansas going way back who had been active in populist politics in the state in the late 19th century. And I thought, well, that's curious. And so I made note of the name of Ed's great-great-grandfather. And when I got home, I Googled his great-great-grandfather and my great-great-great-grandfather just to see if their two names ever coincided anywhere. And they did. They popped up in articles, but I could only read the articles by getting a free 7-day trial subscription to newspapers.com. So that's how I found that resource.
Trial subscription to a website led you to discover something really important about Langston Hughes. That's amazing.
That is absolutely the case. Yeah, I think this is a victory for all people who look up random stuff at 1:30 in the morning on the internet.
Eric McHenry, can you share one last fun fact about little Langston Hughes that you learned in your journey?
Absolutely. Well, in one of those society page items, there was a detail that poor Langston Hughes had fallen into a rose bush and injured himself. But then a week later, the paper happily reported that he was feeling much better.
Well, good. Good, good. Eric McHenry, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Eric McHenry is a Topeka poet and Washburn University professor who discovered that Langston Hughes was born 1 year earlier than we used to think. And that's a wrap for today's show. If you want to hear any of this morning's conversations in their entirety, we'll have them online later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we're talking about walking in Kansas City. I've been hanging out at different intersections, watching things play out between pedestrians and cars, and want to know what you've experienced tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and Kathleen Pointer. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior editor. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.